Welcome to the Press On Podcast. In this episode, we'll hear from Wendy Johnson on women in biblical genealogies.
In the first article in this series, we noted the cultural context and formulation of genealogies. Of importance for the second article is the observation that the culture of the ancient Near East, the milieu of the Israelites, and the background in which the Hebrew Bible was written was patriarchal. Such a society was ruled and controlled by men, while women and children were dependent on men and had lesser status. Lineage and inheritance rights were patrilineal, through the male line, and matrilineal descent was not recorded. We are now going to look at some instances of women in biblical genealogies, particularly noticing the difference between the egalitarian status of women in God's plan and purpose in Genesis, and how women were actually regarded as subordinate to men in ancient Near Eastern culture. Yahweh, the God of Israel, did not intend for the male dominance of a patriarchal culture to be the normative position for the humans that he chose to be in relationship with. Rather, we note the ideal that he instituted at the beginning of the Genesis record. In Genesis 5, verses 1 to 3, we read the following. When God created Adam, he made them in the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them Adam when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. We notice in verses 1 to 2 that both male and female comprised the human beings initially called Adam, and they were created equally in God's image and likeness. It is an egalitarian situation without hierarchy of one over the other. This is no longer seen in 5 verse 3 and following, where the male line is now emphasized and elevated in an ongoing patriarchal context, and Adam is applied to the male alone. Human sons are no longer in the image and likeness of God, but rather in the image of their human fathers, the image of humanity in its sinful state. Females drop out of the formal lineage from Genesis 5, verse 3, holding only supporting roles in genealogies as wives, mothers, sisters, and daughters, as we shall see. The patrilineal genealogies and surrounding narrative document the human failure to live up to the divine ideal. We see this right away in the Genesis text. Eve is so named by her husband because she was the mother of all living. Her fruitfulness forms an inclusio for the events of Genesis 4, which notes that she bears and names two sons, Cain at the beginning and Seth at the end, as well as, incidentally, it seems, her son Abel. However, She does not appear in the patrilineal genealogy of chapter 5, nor are any of her daughters named. Rather, they are included in the summary phrase, "and had other sons and daughters." Women are immediately relegated to subordinate positions and are not often worthy of mention in formal records of generational history. Cain's genealogy in Genesis 4 does, however, mention four women: Cain's unnamed wife, Lamech's two wives, Ada and Zillah, and Zillah's daughter, Naamah. We notice that Naamah is not called daughter, but sister to Tubal-Cain. She is the first daughter or sister mentioned in Genesis. Why do women appear in this genealogy? To answer this question, let us refer back to the segmented genealogical form that we discussed in the previous article. In this form, fewer vertical linear generations are listed, but more individuals are named for each generation. Thus, the horizontal arrangement of the segmented structure is predominant. The patriarchal society was a polygamous one. Men often had several wives and/or concubines as the mothers of their children. In order to record hierarchy and inheritance status of the sons, the names of the mothers needed to be included in the genealogy. An example that we looked at previously was that of Jacob's sons in Genesis 35, where they are listed in accordance with the status of the mothers: Leah first as the senior wife, followed by Rachel, then Rachel's maid, Bilhah, the first maid given by her mistress to Jacob as a concubine, and finally by Zilpah, Leah's maid. For the same reason, we see Lamech's wives named in Cain's genealogy in Genesis 4, in order to make clear the relationship of the sons. However, we don't know why Tubal-Cain's sister Naamah is mentioned. No reason is given in the text. Some women are mentioned in genealogies even when they appear to be the only spouse. We see this in Exodus chapter 6, which we also considered in the last article, where the reason for the inclusion of women is different. We are told here that Amram married his father's sister, Jochebed, in verse 20. She is not called Levi's daughter, nor listed as such in the genealogy. But we are incidentally told that she was Kohath's sister. By giving her family relationship, we learn that both Amram and his aunt became the parents of Aaron and Moses, emphasizing their authority through the Levitical Kohathite line. Notice that Miriam is not mentioned at all, since she is not important for the purpose of this genealogy, which is to establish the credentials of Moses and Aaron as they represent Yahweh and his covenant people before Pharaoh. Next, in verses 22 to 23, we hear of Elisheba, the wife of Aaron and the mother of their four sons. She is called a daughter, the daughter of Aminadab, as well as sister of Nahshon. We learn from 1 Chronicles 2 verses 10 to 15 that Aminadab and Nahshon were of the tribe of Judah. And through their lineage would come David the king. So the marriage of Elisheba to Aaron connected the priestly clan of Levi with the royal line of Judah. And mentioning it in this text emphasizes the authority and status of Aaron, and thus also of Moses, his brother. We notice that this genealogy goes beyond both the lifetimes of Aaron and Moses and the events narrated in the text. This would indicate either that the genealogy was added later, or that the text itself was written or redacted later than the events it describes. It was included to highlight and stress the authority held by Moses and Aaron as the spokesman of their God, Yahweh, when they stood before Pharaoh. So the addition of genealogies can also help us to date the final redaction of biblical texts, the form that is included in the Hebrew Bible that we use. Not only does 1 Chronicles 2 link Nahshon to Elisheba, as we have noticed, but it also lists him as the grandfather of Boaz, who was in turn the great-grandfather of David. Telescoping may have occurred in several places in this genealogy without us being aware of it, so that the connection is not as generationally close as indicated by the record. The patrilineal linear genealogy from Judah's son Perez to David is listed in Ruth 4, verses 18 to 22. There is no segmented branching in this genealogy, nor are any women listed, as the purpose is to show the Judahite lineage which is ascribed honor from its important descendant, David, the king. In this genealogy, Boaz is named as the legal father of Obed in the line of Judah. Even though no women are named in this genealogy, three of the women who appear in Matthew's genealogy appear silently here, and our knowledge of the narrative helps us to fill in the gaps. Perez, the son of Tamar. Boaz, the son of Rahab. And Obed, the son of Ruth. Even Bathsheba can be inferred at the end of the genealogy, linked to David. While the formal patrilineal genealogy is easily recognizable in the text, another, shorter genealogy is given as well in verse 17. This genealogy implies the Levirate connection through Ruth's first husband, Mahlon. However, rather than giving Mahlon's name, Naomi's name is cited, as though she had borne Obed to replace her dead sons. Thus, the shame she had experienced as a childless widow was replaced with the honor of another child, one who would be the ancestor of King David. More importantly, a woman is placed in the genealogy as though she was a male, as an ancestor of David. This too affords her honor. Notice that these genealogies also go beyond the events and individuals narrated in the text of Ruth. Again, this would infer either a later addition of the genealogies to an earlier text, a later redacted text from earlier traditions, or a later original dating of the narrative itself. The genealogies and narrative of the text of Ruth probably serve to ratify and ascribe honor to David's origins, despite the family link to Moab. The honorable behavior of Ruth in being willing to leave her land and gods to cleave to Yahweh and his people is pivotal to this story. Her son is included in the royal line of Judah. We move on now to study the occurrence of women in the Chronicles genealogies. While we may feel numbed by reading the long list of names, the relative scarcity of women in genealogies should have us noticing the ones who are listed, whether named or unnamed. They were obviously regarded as significant enough to be included, even though we don't always know the reason. Often we just have their names without any information to flesh out the person or her importance either in society or the Hebrew Bible. We have noted that biblical genealogies summarize covenant history. And here, the chronicler uses them to connect the returning exiles all the way back to the man first called into covenant with Yahweh, Adam. He thus seeks to reestablish their national identity as the people of God, not forgotten by him. One of his primary goals in composing this history is to emphasize the importance of the Davidic monarchy and the continuing hope for its reestablishment. Thus, the longest and most detailed genealogy is that of Judah. And of the 35 women mentioned in the genealogies in Chronicles, 26 are in that of Judah. Chronicles was redacted in the post-exilic era when Persia was the ruling power. Women of the Persian period were apparently more independent and active in commerce, contributing to family life in ways that extended beyond the household. The well-known text of Proverbs 31, verses 10 to 31, which describes the woman who is involved in many areas of industry and enterprise, both inside and outside the household, is thought to date from this period and to reflect the activities of women at this time. Let's look at some of the women named by the chronicler in the genealogies of the tribes of Israel. The information describing them is much more brief than we would like. David's sisters, Zeruiah and Abigail, are named in 1 Chronicles 2, 16 to 17. Zeruiah is said to be the mother of three sons without reference to a husband. That is, she is not defined by her husband, but appears independently in the text like a male. Abigail's husband is named almost as an afterthought, as the father of their son, rather than as her husband. And their sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. The sons of Zeruiah, Abishai, Joab, and Asahel, 3. Abigail bore Amasa, and the father of Amasa was Jether, the Ishmaelite. The motif of city building is usually assigned to males, especially kings. However, Shearer of the tribe of Ephraim is said to have built both Lower and Upper Beth Horon and Uzen Shearer. The last city is named after her, and the first two cities appear as boundary markers in the allotment of the land in Joshua 6, verses 3 and 5. What she achieved was very significant for her gender in her cultural context. 1 Chronicles 3, verse 19, names Shelomith as the sister of the sons of Zerubbabel. She is the daughter of Zerubbabel, a descendant of David, who returned from exile. However, she is not listed as a daughter, but as a sister. She is the only woman mentioned amongst the descendants of Solomon. The archaeological find of a Judean seal dating to the late 6th century BCE may provide an interesting link to Zerubbabel's daughter. The name Shelomith is inscribed together with that of Elnathan the governor. Eric Myers questions whether Elnathan, as the governor following Zerubbabel, wished to ally himself with the house of David so as to strengthen his position and status. Miriam is listed with Aaron and Moses as the children of Amram in 1 Chronicles 6, verse 3. She is not called sister or daughter in the text to denote her as female, but appears on an equal footing with the males, except that she is named last. David's legitimate sons are listed in 1 Chronicles 3, verses 1 to 9, and almost as an afterthought, Tamar is named as their sister at the end of the list. 2 Samuel 13, verse 1 tells us that she was actually Absalom's sister. But Chronicles does not place her with Absalom and their mother, Maacah, daughter of Talmai of Geshur, in verse 2. Perhaps this was due to the shame of her rape by Amnon. But then why does the chronicler mention her at all when he is at pains to narrate only the good bits of the Davidic history? We don't know. These are only a few of the interesting women who are mentioned by the chronicler, but I hope I've whetted your appetite so that you will notice more of them next time you read these genealogies. One of the reasons that we are fascinated by Matthew's genealogy is that it includes 4 women, besides Mary, Jesus' mother. Having looked at how women appear in genealogies in the Hebrew Bible, let us come to the women noted here. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and the wife of Uriah. Why has Matthew named some women? For what purpose? As we noted with regard to Old Testament genealogies, women were often listed in order to indicate the status of their children. This doesn't seem to be the reason in Matthew. nor are any of the matriarchs of Israel mentioned. Neither Sarah, nor Rebekah, nor Leah appear in this record. In the very first chapter of his Gospel of the Kingdom of Heaven, as Matthew introduces the Messiah to his readers, he is upfront about the unusual circumstances of Jesus' conception. He notes that Mary became pregnant while she and Joseph were betrothed, before they were officially married and sexual intercourse between them was sanctioned. Joseph was enlightened by an angel as to the divine origin of this pregnancy, but no doubt there were those in the community who gossiped about premarital sex and the shame of a baby before formal marriage. This seems to me to be the most likely reason for the women whom Matthew chooses to name in the genealogy. Those who had also had unusual and perhaps shameful circumstances surrounding their sexual liaisons. Matthew names them in order to support Mary and give validity to her situation, and so that Jesus is not shamed. Despite everything, the sons of these women were included in the royal line of Judah. We know the story of Tamar and her seduction of Judah well. Judah had failed in his duty to provide a husband for Tamar, so she was forced to remedy the situation herself. Nevertheless, the shame had to be borne by her. Rahab was an innkeeper and possibly a prostitute. Although she came to believe in Israel's God, Yahweh, and allied herself with his people, the stain of her reputation may have lingered on. Ruth, a Moabitess, had to have recourse to a Levirate marriage after the death of her husband in Moab. Her shame as a widow and a stranger to Israel was redeemed by Boaz. Her son was included in the line of Judah, with Boaz named as father, despite the Levirate tradition to give him Mahlon's lineage and inheritance rights. The fact that Matthew calls Bathsheba the wife of Uriah definitely highlights the irregular sexual relationship she experienced with David. Although I find this explanation the most plausible, others are convinced by a possible Gentile link. However, I find this argument less solid. While we know that Rahab was a Canaanite and Ruth a Moabite, we don't know Tamar's origins. She could have been a Canaanite who married into Judah's family, but this is not clear. Bathsheba married a Hittite, but the text seems to suggest that she was from Judah. Regardless, that Matthew doesn't mention the fact that Uriah was a Hittite seems to detract from the strength of this argument. Mary herself was not a Gentile, and this connection would have no relevance for her, although it could point to the inclusion of Gentiles in Jesus' new family. In conclusion, we have demonstrated that the place of a woman in patrilineal genealogies is usually in a supporting role that informs the status of the men with whom she is associated. Some women are mentioned when they have done something that the ancient author or redactor thinks is worthy of mention, but they are relatively few in number, and the reason may not be disclosed to the reader. We have noted the egalitarian status of men and women intended by Yahweh at the beginning of the record of his relationship with human beings. However, instead, genealogies mark the prevalent patriarchal culture and the subordinate status assigned to women within it. In our third and final article, we will consider the genealogies of Jesus in more depth and also see what we may infer from the New Testament about the place of genealogies for those adopted by God. Importantly, we will notice the reinstatement of an egalitarian situation for women and men in God's family.
Thanks for joining us on the Press On podcast. You've been listening to Wendy Johnson. For more, you can visit pressonjournal.org.